The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Stephen Grismer. He joins us on the telephone in Dayton, and he's got a new book out. It's called The Dean Dillinger and Dayton, Ohio, Legend, Lore, Legacy. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much, Vic. I'm glad to be here.
Stephen, the Dean, nobody knows who that is. Dillinger, a lot of people know who that was, and Dayton, Ohio, of course, goes without saying.
Right.
How did you come up with the idea for writing this?
Well, it actually came out of an exhibit that we have at Carillon Park. I am a trustee with the Dayton Police History Foundation, and we have, over the past 10 years or so, put together a number of exhibits. And one of the exhibits that we put together opened 2019, Carillon Park, and it's called Bootleggers, Bandits, and Badges from Dry Times to Hard Times in Dayton, Ohio. And it basically covers these distinct periods in national history, Ohio history, Dayton police history, and that's the temperance movement, prohibition, and the Great Depression. And so out of that exhibit, I decided that, you know, there needed to be more than just the images that themselves that are there at the exhibit, more than the artifacts and more than the storyboards. There needed to be a fuller story, and that's how this book came about.
The book is The Dean Dillinger and Dayton, Ohio, Legend, Lore, Legacy. Steve Grismer joins me. Steve, we're not going to talk about the Dean just yet because Dillinger pretty much steals the headline on this. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with who John Dillinger was, but for those who are not, who was John Dillinger?
John Dillinger was probably the most infamous gangster to come out of the 1930s and maybe the most notorious gangster in history. He was an Indiana resident. Found himself in prison in the Indiana state prison system for about 8.5 years. But upon his release, and then he roamed the Midwest with his gang, robbing banks, breaking into police arsenals, stealing guns, causing complete havoc in the Midwest during the 1933 and 1934.
And his roommate, his cellmate in prison, was a guy who had a sister.
Right. Sister was Mary Jenkins Longnecker. Her brother was Jim Jenkins, his cellmate. And that's what brought Dillinger to Dayton, was Jim's sister. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was because oftentimes you'll see newspaper articles, or maybe if you read a book about Dillinger, they'll mention Dayton, Ohio, and they always leave what I call a misimpression, that Dillinger was here two or three times, that he had a girlfriend here, and then he was arrested here, but then was transported away and to another jail, and that was the end of the Dayton story. But the Dayton story is a lot fuller. There's a lot more to it. It's more involved than just a few visits and a girlfriend here. So I felt that for the Dayton community, for sure, they needed to have a better understanding of that relationship and his visits here to Dayton.
Steve, I think we should probably explain to our listeners that you are a retired Dayton police officer. Therefore, you feel a certain amount of pride in this story.
Absolutely. When I was on the police department, and I joined the Dayton Police Department in 1966, I was appointed to the Dayton Police Academy in 76, and just to give you a little bit of background, I was promoted to the rank of sergeant in March of 1986, but I worked street patrol in the 5th District, which would be the area for me west of Salem Avenue, Broadway, Rosedale, Philadelphia, for the people that are familiar with that area. And I also worked a whole variety of assignments, detective section, the chief's office, drug enforcement, internal affairs, the hostage negotiation team. But while I was on the department, You know, I would hear war stories from some of the officers, and I would always hear about Dayton arresting John Dillinger. But I knew very, very little about it. And it wasn't only until after I left the police department and had an opportunity to do a little bit of research that I discovered there was far more to the story.
Some of our listeners probably just perked up. They said, Stephen Grismer, Sergeant Grismer, that's the guy that arrested me. I'm just kidding.
You know, I'm not sure I arrested anybody in my 25-year career.
Good for you. Okay, that brings us to the dean. Who was the dean? I had never heard of him. He sounds like an amazing guy.
He is an amazing guy, and the contrast between he and Dillinger is another story in and of itself, because everybody knows John Dillinger, the man that, quite frankly, for a period of a little bit more than a year, terrorized the Midwest before he was killed in Chicago. But then, on the other hand, on the other side in Dayton, Ohio, you had this gentleman who became the Dayton police chief. His name was Rudolph Worsner. And he was appointed to the department at the very end of 1902. He rose through the ranks to become the chief of police in 1925, and he was still the chief of police in 1949 when he retired. So he had a career that covered five decades, while we had a criminal that was in the Dayton area for a mere 5 weeks. And yet everybody remembers Dillinger. Very few know the dean. Now, why is he called the dean? Chief Worsner was called the dean because in 1935, he was the nation's longest-serving police chief at that particular point in time for all major police departments of 200 that had cities with populations of 200,000 or more. And not only did he become the dean at that particular point in time, but he was still the dean 14 years later when he retired in 1949. Mm. And, of course, you can imagine a police officer that served for nearly 50 years had quite a bit that happened throughout the course of his career.
And, Steve, you give us quite a historical arc here. This is really kind of a history of the early days of policing in Dayton and clear up into the time when the dean retired. You go back and you look at all the ways things changed. Start at the beginning. Go back and tell us what the police were like initially and then how they changed, particularly under the chief's command.
Sure. Well, to begin with, policing didn't really exist until the mid-1800s, the middle of the 19th century. Prior to policing, all you had were maybe some privately paid watchmen or voluntary watchmen walking the streets at night. Policing really didn't come around until, as I said, mid-19th century, and it started in New York City and Boston and major cities on the East Coast, Philadelphia. And the concept of organized police departments moved to the Midwest. It moved to Cincinnati, which was the sixth largest city in the nation in 1860. So when policing began in Dayton and in Cincinnati and a lot of these other police departments, it was pretty primitive. The concept was give a man a club, put him in a neighborhood, have him step into bars, check things out, and if anybody was unruly, if anybody was drunk, they were to grab the man, take him to a jail cell. Simple as that. And if the man resisted, you use the club. Uh-huh. There wasn't very much sophistication to policing in the early days. These people that, these men, and it was a man's profession, who walked a police beat, weren't necessarily educated, but they were rough and they were tough. But over the course of time, policing evolved. And policing evolved for a lot of reasons, and you know, I like to attribute some of the evolution of policing having come about because of the various women's movements that were going on at the time. Mm. The temperance movement, the suffrage movement. Women became more involved and more concerned about the welfare of families, children. And so they naturally started looking at law enforcement and how they were handling the job. So that's kind of the long version that takes us to Chief Worsner. Chief Worsner then joins the police department, as I said, very early in the 20th century, and was one of those officers that walked a beat. But over the course of time, he rose in rank. At the time that he was rising in rank, things were changing in society in general. Automobiles were coming about. You know, they were replacing horses. Mm-hmm. The other technological innovations were coming about, communications, telephones, and soon radios. And Chief Worsner was able to look at all these new innovations that were coming about in society and could see how they could be applied to police work. And it was, quite frankly, through a lot of his efforts that law enforcement evolved and became more sophisticated and turned into what I consider a profession today. And at the same time, he always lived what he called by the golden rule. And so he believed that policing should be a profession where police officers would get to know their community, would stop in and visit the businessmen on their beats, and basically perform what we consider community-based policing today.
And it was under the chief's command and oversight that Dillinger was apprehended in Dayton, and this is really the central story in the book as far as I think what readers are going to be absolutely delighted to read, because you build it up. You actually had access to letters that Dillinger was writing his girlfriend and letters that she was writing back to him. Where'd these come from?
Well, the Dayton Police Department had for years in their record section letters and criminal records of a number of felons from this area, which would include Dillinger and others like Al Fouts and George Bugs Moran and a few other people that were arrested here in Dayton. The ones that were most notable, though, were in the record section, and by the mid-1980s, they were fading, deteriorating, and Chief James Newby, who was the police chief at the time, he authorized them to go to Wright State University to their archive collection. Oh. Because he knew that the archivist there could help preserve those particular records. So these letters that were in the police file, the mug shots, the fingerprint cards, and all of those documents, they're all at Wright State University in their special collections and archives. And that's where I went to get details that I needed to put together this book.
All right, so we've got Dillinger in prison, and he's learning about his cellmate's sister. And when he gets out, he starts a relationship with her, and that keeps bringing him to Dayton to visit her. And she's living in this boarding house.
Right.
And the way that they trapped Dillinger was so ingenious. And I think one aspect of this that you didn't mention as far as the upgrades that the police were going through was the weaponry, because of all these gangsters running loose. The Dayton police really ratcheted up their weaponry, and they were ready for Dillinger.
They absolutely were. In the 1920s, police officers were still performing their functions much like they had 70 years earlier when we had watchmen. They were walking a beat. They would carry a nightstick. They'd swing it around their, you know, on their wrist from a leather strap, and by this time they were now carrying guns. But the guns were 5- and 6-shot revolvers. In the 1920s, though, there was an uptick in crime, a serious uptick in crime, and the weaponry used by criminals was weapons that actually came out of World War One, and they were high-powered weapons, and the police departments were having a difficult time competing with those weapons, and in particular the Colt Thompson submachine gun, you know, which could run off, you know, with a single trigger pull, you know, 50 rounds of ammunition, was devastating to police. So in 1927, the Dayton Police Department suffered quite a few deaths. there were five Dayton lawmen that died basically in a five-month span in five separate incidents. And it was at that point that the police department said, what we need to do is start to improve the weaponry and the equipment that we had. And so they started purchasing Tommy guns, shotguns, bulletproof vests, gas grenades, just a whole assortment. They started to increase, or actually create, an arsenal of weapons. And that's what they needed at the time that Dillinger and other gangsters were coming to Dayton.
And I'm not going to give out all the details of how they apprehended Dillinger, but they got him. This is a very dangerous guy, and they worked it just right, so they were able to trap him without anybody getting hurt. And then after they had him, that was a big problem because they were really concerned that some of his thuggish pals were going to break him out. And during this exact same period, a big prison break was about ready to take place, and Dillinger was behind it.
That's right. It happened at the Indiana State Prison. It was the largest jailbreak ever to happen in the history of Indiana. All of these inmates that Dillinger had palled around with for 8.5, almost 9 years, were murderers, robbers, men of that ilk. And Dillinger helped devise a plan that they used to break out of that prison. And once they were out free, the concern here in Dayton and in other communities was that that gang was going to rescue their liberator, who was Dillinger. And in fact, that's what they did. But they didn't do it here in Dayton. They did it in another location.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, while Dillinger was in the jail in Dayton, they really had him under tight guard. They had lots of police watching because they were really concerned that these lawless thugs were going to come in there and break him out.
Absolutely. And they it wasn't just Chief Worsner and Inspector Seymour Yendis, who was the chief of detectives here in Dayton, that had that concern and made provisions to ensure there was 24-hour-a-day watch over the cell by armed police officers with Tommy gun, but also the Montgomery County Sheriff, because Dillinger was transported to the sheriff's jail several days after he was arrested here in Dayton. The sheriff made sure that he was under tight guard. And then even when he was transported from Dayton to Lima, Ohio, to the Allen County Sheriff's Office, they were so concerned that they made sure that there was an escort from both the sheriff's office and the police department to at least the midpoint of the trip to Allen County. So, yeah, there was no doubt that they were worried that this was a formidable bad guy and that others were out to get him out of jail so they could wreak havoc, you know, throughout the Midwest, which is exactly what they did for a period of about 10 months or so.
It's the Book Nook. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, building a more informed community with independent news and storytelling. My guest is Stephen Grismer, and his book is The Dean, Dillinger, and Dayton, Ohio, Legend, Lore, Legacy. And Dillinger, he's got quite the personality. I love that crack he made after these guys arrested him, and he noticed they were wearing bulletproof vests, and he's like, hey, what are those? I need to get some of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not only did he see that and notice that, but not too long after he was freed from the jail cell in Lima, that's exactly what he did. Was he and his gang, they went to Indiana and they broke into a police department and stole an arsenal and made sure to take with them a number of these bulletproof vests.
What are some of the locations nearby that he held up? I know he held up the bank in New Carlisle. Can you name some others that are in our listening area that he might have robbed?
Well, in the listening area would be the New Carlisle Bank. That was actually the very first bank that John Dillinger ever robbed.
Really?
Yes. And then they robbed a bank, the Dillinger gang robbed a bank up in St. Mary's, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And that's a kind of an interesting place because St. Mary's, Ohio was the home for one of Dillinger's gang members, a fellow by the name of Charlie Makeley. And there's quite a large family of Makeleys that live up in the St. Mary's area. But Charlie Makeley, after he had broken out of the Indiana State Prison and was with the other gangsters, decided that they needed to take in a big haul of cash before they broke Dillinger free from the jail in Allen County.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking for a place that they didn't have to spend a whole lot of time staking out and preparing for, Charlie decided that the place to go was St. Mary's, Ohio. And so they robbed the bank in St. Mary's, Ohio, successfully. And I can't remember right off the top of my head how much they took, but it was a considerable sum of money. But they also robbed a bank in Bluffton, Ohio. And in fact, that's why Dillinger was transported up to Allen County, because Bluffton, Ohio is in Allen County. And so that was another bank that they robbed here. But they didn't just rob banks in Ohio. They robbed banks in Indiana, just about every state in the Midwest, Indiana, Kentucky, Iowa. I'm trying to think, South Dakota, Illinois, you name it.
They got around.
They got around.
My guest is Stephen Grismer. We're talking about the Dean Dillinger in Dayton, Ohio. And this is quite a story. Some of our listeners probably don't know how Dillinger finally met his end. J. Edgar Hoover was involved.
Right. At the time, people always talk about the FBI taking Dillinger down, but technically the FBI, as an organization today, didn't exist.
Uh-huh.
It was the Bureau. There was a Bureau of Investigation, and prior to that, I believe it was called the Department of Identification or the Department of Investigation. But the G-men, the government men that Hoover's men were called, they weren't armed. They didn't carry guns.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until Congress passed enacted provisions in the law that allowed them to start carrying guns and taking action on a federal level against these criminals who were crossing state lines. You know, in the day, in 33 and 34, jurisdictions took care of their own area, and the federal government really didn't come into play at all. But with these gangsters in high-powered automobiles, knowing that they could leave a jurisdiction and they couldn't be pursued beyond the jurisdictional lines by police, and they would cross state borders, that's when the federal government got involved. And so, in a nutshell, Hoover's men became armed, and then they took part in the search for Dillinger and his gang members, and that led them to finding him in Chicago.
And he went to a movie.
He went to a movie. He was set up by a lady that they termed the Lady in Red, Anna Kapanis, or Anna Sage was the name she went by. She basically set him up. They went to the movie, and as they were leaving the movie, the G-men closed in on Dillinger, and he, having escaped not once, not twice, but about four different times from the hands of law enforcement, decided he could probably escape again. So he took off running towards an alley, but he was gunned down.
And the legend I remember a lot of things as a kid hearing about Dillinger, some you can't talk about on the radio, but I can remember they would always talk about how he would carve guns out of things that looked like guns, and that's how he would escape. And this is really true. He did try that.
He used a gun, a piece of wood, and I'm not sure that he carved it. I believe that someone carved it for him, but it was a piece of wood and then smuggled into the jail. But it was at the Crown Point Jail. It was a piece of wood cut to appear as if it was a gun, and then they used shoe polish to make it black. And that's what he used to fool the jailer there at the Crown Point Jail into believing that he was armed, being released from his cell. And then he ended up at Crown Point. He ended up stealing the sheriff's car.
Right.
And took off from there. But not only did he do it, but these other two characters that were in his gang, when they were convicted and went to the Ohio Penitentiary, Charlie Makeley being one, the other was Harry Pierpont, they too tried to do the same thing by carving a piece of soapstone into the shape of a gun and polishing it except for them, it didn't work.
Those were the days. And when Makeley went into the St. Mary's Bank, his hometown, there was an employee there that looked at him and said, that sure looks like Makeley, our hometown boy, robbing the bank. And there's just so many stories in here and so many illustrations. I need to talk about all these photos. You've got hundreds of photos in here. Did you get these from various places? Were these at Wright State? Were these at Carillon? Where'd you get all these?
Some of them were from Wright State University, from the archive collection that they have there on Dillinger and some of the other people that I talk about in the book. Carillon Park had a number of them. And then over the course of time, our organization, the Dayton Police History Foundation, has gathered or actually received in donations pictures from family members. And you probably noticed when you read the book, Vic, that I make sure to identify pictures that were provided by the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren or the grandnephews or grandnieces of a lot of the police officers that served on the Dayton Police Department at the time. So those, I got a lot of pictures from those. And then, and of course, the Montgomery County or the Dayton Metro Library has photos. And it's just a whole assortment of sources. And I was really, really grateful, by the way, to everyone that contributed pictures to this book.
I've had Kurt Dalton on the show a couple of times, and I think of him as kind of the dean of Dayton historians. I understand that he helped you out a little bit.
Yeah, without a doubt. He's been a guy that's mentored me, quite frankly, over the course of time. He, as you know, I've done two other smaller books in the past, and they were commemorative books related to certain events in Dayton history. And it was Kurt that actually moved me in that direction. And I rely on him quite a bit for advice and counsel, and he's just a wonderful fella. And he has about 30 books about local history. And, you know, I encourage anybody to pick up any of his books. They're all quite good.
He's written about everything from breweries to grave robbers.
Yes. Yes, he has.
Yeah.
Yes, he has. And movie theaters.
Well, Stephen, it's really been a pleasure talking to you about your book.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on your program. And I hope people, and by the way, if I can mention, all the proceeds from the book go to our efforts to get a law enforcement museum at Carillon Park. It's our long-range goal, and so I just want everyone to know that every dime that we receive goes to that project.
Well, Steve, thanks again.
Thank you very much, Vic.
My guest has been Stephen Grismer, and the book is The Dean, Dillinger, and Dayton, Ohio, Legend, Lore, and Legacy. And let me guess, it's available at Carillon.
It absolutely is there.
All right.
And at Amazon.com.
All right. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis.